The History Show with Moz Duncan.
Good evening. On this week's program...
Like so many people, I had heard of Ponzi schemes, but I didn't understand that there was a guy, there was a Ponzi, and that he had been here in Boston where I lived and I was working as a reporter, and it just sent me on the path.
Ponzi and his dastardly scheme, the man whose name is synonymous with financial fraud. Also, war in the West.
Richard Mulcahy and Ono Duffy are on record as saying that, in their opinion, Kerry did very little in the War of Independence, but what I was discovering was the opposite of that.
Local historian Nola Morhu on the hidden history of the Irish Revolution in West Kerry. But to begin this evening, it's been 125 years since the first motor car trundled onto Irish shores. Originally a novelty for rich men, they quickly gained traction in Irish society. According to my first guest, the role played by cars in a developing Ireland should not be underestimated. Historian Leanne Blaney is the author of the book The Motor Car in Ireland, 1896 to 1939. Leanne, you're very welcome indeed to The History Show.
Thanks for having me, Miles.
The book starts, as the title suggests, in 1896, the year the first motor car arrived in Ireland. Tell us about that car and something about the man who imported that car.
So you're completely right. This is the 1896 is the year that the first car is permanently imported into Ireland. In 1895, there had been a German Benz, what we now know as a Mercedes-Benz, had been taken in really to be shown in a bazaar in County Cork for a few days back in 1895. But in 1896, the Serpollet steam car, which is a forerunner of the modern day Peugeot, it arrives in at the behest of John Brown, who was an engineer who lived outside Belfast around the Lisburn area. He had taken his holidays in 1895 in France and along the way had come across this particular car, had had the opportunity to travel in it and had literally got the motoring bug. So he convinced the owner to sell the vehicle to him, and then in the spring of 1896, the car was imported.
So basically he sounds like Toad of Toad Hall. He fell in love with the motor car.
Completely. Toad is a really good representation of an early motorist, to be honest. He personifies very much everything around what those early motorists were about. They love speed, they loved a bit of danger, they loved the excitement, the thrill, all of that.
Dressing up as well?
Yes, very often.
And how long had the motor car been around before it actually arrived in Ireland?
Officially, the start date is given as 1888, but you have to bear in mind, much like all other kind of forms of invention, it was a very multinational process. There were people trying to invent what were termed horseless carriages across the world, both in America and in Europe. One of the key characters that we attribute the first car to is Carl Benz, who was a German engineer, and he creates his vehicle in 1888, shows it in 1889 at the World Fair alongside Gottlieb Daimler, who was also a fellow German. And from there, then, the world becomes fascinated by cars. And you see the car industry really starting to take off from there, so particularly in France and Germany. Britain, which you would have naturally thought should have been the forerunner, given that they had led the way with the railway industry, were very against it, principally because, as you can imagine, in Westminster, the MPs and the key kind of lawmakers tended to have investments in the railway industry. And they very quickly recognised that this form of transport could be detrimental to them. So they put the scruppers on it, basically, for as long as possible, until 1896, when they pushed through a law which takes away what had been the Locomotive Acts of the 1860s and 1870s, which had really restricted the development of any kind of form of mechanised transit on the roads, because it had restricted cars to driving around 4 miles per hour and you had to have three individuals walking around the vehicle with flags warning people to stay away from this.
Three, yeah. I assume I was aware of one guy having to walk in front with a flag, but three.
So initially it was two, then they decided two wasn't enough, so it had to be a third person. And I think that really was, that was the end. You could probably find two people to walk around your car. The third was probably the point of no return, really.
So his lordship basically had to bring the valet, the undergardener and the butler with him anytime he wanted to take his car out, I presume.
Exactly.
And the motor car boom from the 1890s followed on from the bicycle boom, which was a decade and a half earlier. But apparently, unlike today, cyclists were very much in favour of cars.
Cyclists were enamoured with cars entirely because cars were the natural successor, for want of a better word, to what was the speed machine of the day, being a bicycle. So you have to think about the likes of R.J. McCready, who is probably we call him the father of Irish motoring, because he is the man who founded the first Irish motoring magazine in 1900, the Irish Motor News. He had been a competitive cyclist. He was naturally very keen on cycling, much like Alfred Harmsworth, whom we all know to be the founder of the Daily Mail. Both of them were keen cyclists and that became friends through the cycling fraternity and the fact that both of them were involved in editing cycling magazines. And in McCready's case, he had been one of the people who was initial naysayers against cars. But he went to London, and while there, he was taken out for a spin in what he termed an oil pot, which was one of these early vehicles. And again, caught the motoring bug, arrived home a convert, insisted that this was the way forward, and then obviously went on to put his money where his mouth was and made his career around motoring.
So when these strange vehicles started appearing on Irish roads, what did people make of them?
It's an interesting mix. Initially, it's this source of fascination, particularly for young people, as you can imagine. So you've got all the stories of young people, they're living in the middle of rural Ireland, and so when they hear this vehicle chugging down the road, they're willing to run over rivers, streams, fields, etc. to get to see this vehicle, and it's something you talk about for weeks. On the other side, you have more elderly members of the community, for instance, who think this is the worst thing they've ever seen in their life. You've got reports in Irish folk stories that were recorded from the 1930s of women falling to their knees, convinced that this is the devil, and blessing themselves and looking for holy water and running away as quickly as possible. And then you've got other people who are convinced that what is trundling down the road has to be part of the train that came past it maybe at 8:15 in the morning, and that something's fallen off it and it's running away. And who do we contact about this?
Now, some of the early vehicles were powered by steam. Obviously, health and safety wouldn't allow that kind of thing today.
Health and safety wouldn't allow a lot to do with the early cars, let's be honest. Again, it's an absolute hybrid. Anything that they could get to move a vehicle, they tried. So you have initially the early vehicles can either be steam powered, they can be combustion powered, which we refer to as fuel powered engines. Electricity actually is one of the earliest things they try. We obviously associate electric powered cars as very much a 21st century invention. Unfortunately not, it was there from the beginning. You have people trying anything really to kind of power their alcohol. Alcohol was one that they did try for a little while to see if they could power cars with. They thought that would be quite sustainable. And then they realised that probably wasn't a very good idea. So what was actually encouraged was many of the early motorists were encouraged to drink when they were out on their vehicles, because obviously the vehicles were open topped and it was to keep them warm. So it was quite common for you when you were getting ready to go out on your little trip, be it his lordship or her ladyship, they tended to have a flask of whiskey with them.
When it comes to the revolutionary period then, cars play a big role in the Larne gun running of 1914, and by contrast play virtually no role whatever in the Howth gun running. Explain that to me if you would.
The Larne gun running, it's held and staged overnight, as we all know. 600 cars is the figure that's roughly thrown around whenever they talk about the reports. And that actually seems completely possible when you consider that at the time there was 869 cars registered in the Belfast borough alone. So that's perfectly doable. It's important to note that while there's a lot of cars in the country, the number plates are very distinct. So you know who owns the car. And by involving your car, whether you yourself drive it or whether you allow your male sympathiser, be he your brother, your father, your gardener, etc. And it's all men, I should also point that out. Women weren't involved. They were involved in the medical side, that anybody that ran into each other, for instance, and needed medical assistance, there were nurses there to patch them up and take care of them. But women weren't allowed to drive the vehicles. So what happened was the men arrived. Everything was taken off the ships and put onto the cars and then sped across the country to their next destination where they were going to be stored. It was seen as a sense almost of domination, of how modern and how contemporary the UVF were, that they had this number of vehicles, this modern form of transit at their beck and call, and they could use it for the purpose. So it's a very powerful symbol. In contrast, the Hoth gun running, at the same time, Dublin has about 960 cars registered by 1914 in the local vicinity. We know for a fact the likes of Bulmer Hobson and his sympathisers all had ready access to cars. And actually, cars do travel to Hoth to witness the gun running. But Bulmer Hobson, as Marnie Hayes says herself, was very distinct and very determined that this was to be a theatrical performance. And so he insisted that people carry the guns back into Dublin. And as we know, there was obviously the results that occurred. In contrast, then a couple of months later, you have the Kilkeel gun running, which again is for the national side of things. During that one, it's a much smaller gun running, but they use a charabanc at that point and taxis. And it proves to be much more successful and obviously doesn't have the fatal consequences of the Hoth gun running.
Now, during the War of Independence, what was the attitude of the Crown forces towards people who had cars? Were they objects of suspicion?
Yes, is the simple answer there, Miles. Cars were seen as advantageous to both sides. So the Crown forces obviously wanted to get their hands on as many cars as possible. And you see Winston Churchill in his remarks made in the House of Commons at the time that there's a huge drive to supply the Crown forces with as many cars and motorised vehicles as possible. You also see attempts made to take cars off people who are suspected or recognised as being sympathetic to the local insurgents. That comes in through the form of an order that was released in 1919. And that led to actually a strike for 3 months where everybody that was in the motor trade really stepped aside from what they were doing because they were protesting against this suspicion being put on them by the Crown forces that everybody that was involved in the motor trade or a chauffeur, for instance, was somehow naturally sympathetic to the opposition of what was the lawful forces, for want of a better word. On saying that, the Crown forces were completely correct. There was a huge amount of commandeering by the insurgents, and you have numerous stories of IRA forces commandeering a car and then actually having to kidnap the driver because while it was a great idea to get the car, they couldn't actually drive it. So they needed the driver to go with them to their point of destination.
What about partition then? Did that in any way affect motoring on the island? I mean, one can almost imagine that the Irish Free State, just out of badness, might have advocated something like, let's go for driving on the right-hand side of the road, for example. Well, that obviously didn't happen. But there must have been a temptation there at some point.
Absolutely. What you see immediately after partition is very quickly a divide in terms of motoring attitudes and how the state treats motorists. In Northern Ireland, things continue as normal. As part of the United Kingdom, motoring is recognised as part of a modern society and it's encouraged. So things stay as is, really. In the Free State, what you see is an economically deprived new state needing money, and they recognise these motorists as having money. So they are willing to overlook the fact that many people who are involved in the motor industry are working class, they don't have a great deal of money, they're not particularly prosperous, but they need their cars for their everyday income. They don't focus on that. What they do is instead they drive up the motor license duty that you pay at the time to have your motor license to have your car, and they drive up fuel prices. And that money that's generated really helps to drive part of the economy alongside death duties, which obviously is the other big money maker in the Free State.
Something else that helps to drive the economy, of course, is the arrival of the Ford Motor Company to Cork. What was that all about? I mean, it can't have been for economic reasons, surely.
Absolutely not. It was an anomaly. And Henry Ford himself, who we famously think of as being very pragmatic, a great strategist, and in many ways actually quite unemotional, he admitted himself in his diaries that this was really driven by his own personal desire to bring industry to the city where his ancestors had come from. So he goes against all economic sense, all advice from his staff, etc. And he insists that they are to build a factory in Cork. Their way around that in 1917 is that the First World War is underway and Britain needs tractors for their agricultural produce and for encouraging that. So he gets a law passed that he will be allowed to build in Cork. However, by the time that they procure the site down in the marina in Cork, time has passed, the war has ended, and it doesn't actually open until 1919. The factory opens, and from the beginning, it's up against it in terms of economics. In modern metrics of productivity, it wouldn't have lasted, absolutely not. The first big problem is Ireland, whilst agricultural, there's not enough money in Irish agriculture to afford small farmers in the Midlands, for instance, to buy tractors are very expensive. Also, again, we're at this stage, we're in the War of Independence. And the last thing that anybody wanted to do was invest a lot of money into a vehicle, which was very likely either going to be burnt or potentially commandeered. So all tractors really that were produced were being taken out of the country. What you also have at the time is he had taken in his managerial staff from America, and a lot of those people became targets for both the Black and Tans and also the IRA forces within Cork, because again, these are prosperous people, they are high profile within Cork City. To hold them up and to make their lives difficult, it means you're going to get notoriety and you're going to get it in the press, and everybody wants that on both sides. So again, you see in the letters back people saying, what's the plan here? Are we going to keep going with this? Are we not? Because again, at the same time, Ford has a factory in Manchester and in Dagenham at the time. So from his advisor's perspective, they're going, we have this factory in Britain where you have an infrastructure, where you have a workforce that are highly skilled. Why are we continuing with what's in Cork? And Henry Ford pushes it through and continues to push for it. And actually then his descendants, his grandsons, when they come to run the company, they continue it right through until the joining of the EEC in the 1970s, when it just does eventually become completely economically inviable.
As does every other car manufacturing plant in the country, as it happens. Now, the book ends in 1939, so you don't actually cover World War II. But in terms of the acceptance of the motor car in the wider public, where are we on the eve of the Second World War?
On the eve of the Second World War, we are in a position where Ireland, both Northern Ireland and by that stage the Republic, has recognised that the car is here to stay. Not everybody necessarily can afford it as of yet. Higher purchase comes in the post-Second World War era, but it's accepted that cars are mandatory. They're part of the future. There's no question in that. And people are very familiar with them. They may not have a car, but most people have certainly driven and been driven in a car. And they're symbols to aspire to. There's a glamour with them, there's a sense of danger with them, there's a sense, obviously, of prosperity with them that people aspire to across Ireland. And that obviously never goes away.
Certainly hasn't so far, anyway. The book is called The Motor Car in Ireland, 1896 to 1939. It's published by Liffey Press. The author is Leanne Blaney. Leanne, many thanks for joining us on The History Show this evening.
Thanks so much, Miles.
After the break, we'll be hearing about one of history's greatest fraudsters, Charles Ponzi. Stay with us.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Welcome back. Last week, the American financier and convicted fraudster Bernie Madoff died in prison at the age of 82. His was the largest fraud in Wall Street history. He swindled investors out of an unbelievable $60 billion in what is known as a Ponzi scheme.
And a Ponzi scheme.
Ponzi scheme.
Ponzi scheme.
Bernie Madoff's Ponzi scheme.
A $50 billion Ponzi scheme, the SEC.
The phrase Ponzi scheme is named after Charles Ponzi, the Italian-American swindler whose money-making operation became a sensation a century ago. Colm Flynn has been finding out more about Ponzi. He spoke to author Mitchell Zukoff.
Ponzi was a native of Italy. He was born in Lugo in 1882, and he was the son of a postman in this small community, and his mother was a member of the sort of the more royalty side of the world.
And something he had realized at a young age, Mitchell, that he liked spending money and living the good life.
Indeed, he did. And that was part of his downfall, both then and later. That was very much part of his DNA. He fell in with a crowd while he was there in Rome of wealthy Italians, wealthy young Romans, who could outdrink him and outspend him, and they did. And he ended up leaving the University of Rome because he ran out of money. And then at 21, like so many Italians of the era, he was going to seek his fortune by coming across the Atlantic to the United States.
In 1903, 21-year-old Charles Ponzi left Italy for Boston in the United States with the dream of making it big someday.
I read a great quote where he said that he arrived in Boston with something like $2.50 in his pocket, but $1 million in dreams.
Yes, that was very much Ponzi. He was very lyrical in all of his thinking and his writing. What he didn't mention in that was that he had lost all of his money in a card game on the boat on the way across. So that's why he was so impoverished upon his arrival here.
So was this always in his DNA, trying to make a dollar, gambling? I mean, this started from a young age, it seems.
I think the ambition, the wanting to make a dollar, the effort to, you know, fulfill those million-dollar dreams were always part of his DNA.
And Mitchell, what was his ambition? What did he want to do when he arrived on the U.S. shores?
He came here as a 21-year-old, and I don't think he had specific ambitions other than wealth. And he was a sort of a diminutive man. He was about 5'1 or 5'2", and he was not going to make it in the factories. He was not going to make it by, you know, the way a lot of Italian stonemasons came over, for instance. That was not going to be him. And so he knew he had to use his brain to make money. He set out to become rich, certainly. I don't think he set out to swindle.
For the next 17 years, he moved across the United States, trying to find his way and make his fortune, failing at each job, one after the other.
He was a road drummer. He was a sign painter. He did every menial job he could find. He went from job to job, from city to city, and none were really very successful. Eventually, he ended up in Montreal and worked for a bank up there, and that did not end well at all because the banker up there was running his own scheme, and Ponzi, who was really not a participant in it, got caught up in it and ended up going to prison. So those were hard years for him.
How long did he spend in prison?
The first time, always a funny way. First time it was about a couple of years for forging a check.
And you would think that first brush with the law, even though it wasn't entirely his fault, would deter him from meddling in things that were illegal in the future. You'd think that he would want to stay on the straight and narrow after spending 3 years in the slammer.
You and I would think that. But Ponzi was always looking for an angle. And almost immediately upon being released from prison, this was just unfortunate. He fell into an immigrant smuggling scheme, just sort of helping some other fellow Italians cross the border from Canada back into the United States, and was immediately caught, and he was sent to prison again for the second time.
But he was a likable guy, I believe. Charismatic, easy to get on with. He had a good personality, it seems.
Absolutely. I think even the people who were investigating him enjoyed his company. He would almost invariably, in both of these prison stints, ended up working for the warden. He was a likable fellow, and he was, as you say, enormously charismatic.
And he had that quality that all good con men have, where the word comes from. He had confidence.
Indeed. He walked through the world like he was leading a band. That kind of confidence is contagious. You know, he wasn't sort of looking for trouble, but trouble kept finding him.
It's funny you say that about looking for trouble. Wasn't there a quote where he said once, "I went looking for trouble and boy, I found it."
I guess I paraphrased him. Yes, you got me on that. That's absolutely correct.
"I went out looking for trouble. I found it. Only I found more than I had anticipated."
It was 1919, and Charles Ponzi was out of prison for a second time. He was back in Boston. He'd fallen in love, and he had just come up with an idea that would become one of the most infamous swindles of all time, earning the name the Ponzi Scheme.
He decided that he was going to open up an import-export magazine, and he got from a correspondent in Europe a little coupon. And it was an international reply coupon. It was a way to help someone buy stamps in another country. He realized that because of World War I, certain countries had their currencies that were depressed, and he thought he could take advantage of differences in currency prices to buy these little coupons in mass, cheaply, in Europe, and transfer them into large amounts of money in the United States.
And the idea was legal. He could have done it and it would have been legal and above board.
Theoretically, yes. Theoretically, you could, if you could purchase these, and then if you could find a way to transfer them into cash or stamps, I guess, in another country, yes, you could have. But it was practically impossible.
But that did not deter Ponzi.
No, it did not stop him. But once the money started rolling in and the idea wasn't working, he had to make a decision.
Wow. So he did not want to go back to the people who had invested their money with them and say, look, this isn't going to work out. It actually is impractical. Instead, he decided simply to tell them that he was buying the coupons, they were making a return, and he would just pocket the money.
Exactly. Exactly. And you know, you have to sort of stop for a second. So this is a man, he's pushing 40, he's married, he has these dreams that have never subsided. And that's when he became the Ponzi whose name we associate with the swindle.
If I were a rich man, yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum.
How did he convince so many people, Mitchell, to invest with him? Because as you said, the returns were just astronomical. 45 days, he said he would double your investment. In 90 days, you'd make 100% back in your investment. Too good to be true, but people just couldn't resist the lure of this.
Exactly. What I've often said is that too good to miss trumps too good to be true.
Mm.
That there's a part of our nature that says, you know, I'm not sure about this. This seems too good to be true. But boy, maybe this is my big chance.
How big did it get?
Into the millions.
Would it spoil some vast eternal plan?
There were lines around the block.
If I were a wealthy man.
And money was pouring in $1 million a week and only growing.
Charles Ponzi, self-styled financial wizard, loafing at his Boston mansion with his lovely wife and proud and adoring mother. Ponzi's proved his boast he can make 50% profit on investments in 90 days, and wise men follow him.
Were people getting suspicious? Were people thinking something must be up here, even his wife and those close to him?
I'm not sure his wife did. Rose was just truly besotted with Ponzi. She loved him. She adored him. But the authorities did start poking around when the Boston Post, the newspaper, one of the most important newspapers of the day, started sort of wondering, who is this guy?
When did it all come crashing down?
In the summer, things started getting hot for him in the summer of 1920. The Boston Post pursued him relentlessly. He said he was going to stop taking investments. He tried to sort of shut it all down because he knew it was unsustainable. And because the attorney general was breathing down his neck and the bank commissioner and the district attorney. And he said, I'll stop.
Spellbound here is later dumbfounded when government proves Ponzi a swindler.
It was the biggest news story of 1920, by far. I mean, and for years after. And Ponzi immediately entered the lexicon. And you said the word Ponzi, you might as well, you know, be, you know, saying the devil's name at that point.
Ponzi's wife, Rose, pleaded with him to plead guilty. And so he did, and was given just a 5-year sentence. And when he was released from prison, he returned to Italy, as he had never become an American citizen. and after some time in Italy, he then moved for a final time to South America, to Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, where he would live out his elderly years. And right up until the end, he continued to scheme and try to come up with new ideas to make a fortune.
He never stopped trying. I mean, he never made it. He never reached these heights that he had here in Boston.
Isn't it incredible the fact that he even had the confidence to keep on trying after what he had been through?
I think he realized at that point there was no other option for him. I think the die was cast. Once his name was universally known the way it was, I don't think there was really a second act for him.
In his research for his book on Ponzi, Mitchell found various stories of charity and kindness Ponzi showed to others. On one occasion, even giving the skin off his own back to someone else.
He told a story in his memoir about donating a swath of skin from his back to a young nurse who had been burned in a mining accident. And there was actually an account in a small newspaper down in Alabama of this incident.
It's amazing, those little stories of humanity among all the scamming and the con artist that he was.
It makes him much more appealing.
Through his trials and tribulations, his wife Rose still loved him. And it was only when Ponzi decided to leave the United States that the two split, although both continued to write to each other until he died in 1949.
I have his last letter to Rose, and it's a poignant love letter. He was poor, but he still had a bit of the Ponzi in him, remembering their good times, complimenting her figure. It's a really sweet letter, and so I think the optimism, the confidence, the charisma that characterized him all his life was still there at the very end.
He was a charmer until the very end.
Very much so.
And what do you think of when you hear the name Charles Ponzi? What do you feel towards him as a person?
It's a great question. I have really complicated feelings. I have to admit, I have a certain amount of affection for him. He was irrepressible. He did a bad thing and he hurt people. And I don't ignore that. But at the same time, I am aware that the two things that the schemer and the schemed often have in common is that they have both a tremendous sense of greed. And so a lot of the people who he was scheming were no less greedy than he was. There are a lot worse people out there. Let me put it that way.
I went out looking for trouble. I found it. More than I had anticipated.
Colin Flynn was reporting there. He was talking to Mitchell Zukoff about the life of Italian swindler and con artist Charles Ponzi. Mitchell's book is called Ponzi's Scheme, the true story of a financial legend. After the break, we'll be hearing about the War of Independence in West Kerry.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Welcome back. In recent years, there's been a huge quantity of material written about the Irish Revolutionary period, focusing on the local level, events and personalities in individual counties, towns and parishes. We're looking now at a new book which uncovers the hidden history of the War of Independence in West Kerry. It's called War in the West, 1918 to 1923, The Struggle for Irish Independence on the Dingle Peninsula. The author is local historian Noel O'Murricu. Noel, you're very welcome indeed to the History Show.
Thank you, Miles.
Why did you decide to write this book and to focus on West Kerry in particular?
Well, obviously, I'll take the second part of your question first. I am a West Kerry man originally, and I would have an interest in local history for all my life, really. In 2018, I did a book, actually, about a granduncle of mine, Tomás Rochelle, who was killed by British forces in Carrigaholt in County Clare in March 1918. And it was in the course of researching that book that I discovered there was a wealth of material available through witness statements, brigade reports, etc. And the more I delved into it, the more I became convinced that this needed to be put down, because whether you might be aware of it, but whether you're aware of it or not, the general view of Kerry's contribution to the War of Independence is not great. The likes of Richard Mulcahy and Eoghan Duffy are on record as saying that they, in their opinion, Kerry did very little in the War of Independence. But what I was discovering was the opposite of that. So I decided to put pen to paper again and record the stuff I was finding out. And the result is this book.
Now, the book itself, it's long, it's 300 pages, and it only really covers two battalion areas of that part of Kerry. So obviously there's a wealth of material. We'll come to that in a few moments, but let's talk first of all about 1916, because Kerry was key to the plans for the Easter Rising. Why was that?
Kerry was indeed key to the plans for the Easter Rising. The decision to land 20,000 rifles in Bannerstrand on the Easter weekend in preparation for the Rising was not accidental. The original idea behind the Rising was to uprise in Dublin, fight there for maybe a week, and then fall back to the south and southwest and use the volunteers there to set up a line, a front, basically, to defend against the English. The failure of the arms to land and the subsequent failure of the Rising really put a halt to that. But it had an effect on Kerry especially. The commanding officer in Kerry at the time was Austin Stack, and his second in command was Paddy Cahill. Stack got arrested on Easter Saturday, which left Cahill in overall charge of the volunteers. There was about 600 volunteers massed in Tralee Easter Saturday night. But it seems Cahill did not know what the plans were for the Rising. It seems Stack did not inform him. And Cahill subsequently finished up being blamed by people. And I believe myself that it certainly coloured his view towards GHQ, and that had a very big bearing on matters in Kerry between 1918 and 1922. By 1919, when the War of Independence broke out, Cahill was in charge of the Kerry No. 1 Brigade. In early 1919, Richard Mulcahy, who was the Chief of Staff of the IRA, set in place a system whereby the brigades would report to him every month as to whatever actions they were carrying out. These actions, they're available in UCD, in the Mulcahy papers, under the Brigade Activity section. Now, I went through them, and there was actually no report there from Paddy Cahill on activities. Whether that was because of his distrust of GHQ or not, I have no way of saying. But it certainly gave Richard Mulcahy the impression that there was nothing happening in the No. 1 Brigade area in Kerry.
So the area that you're covering is the Kerry No. 1 Brigade, and there were three brigades in Kerry. Kerry No. 1 was North and West Kerry, and that was made up at different times of seven or eight battalions altogether. Now, as you mentioned, Paddy Cahill took charge of this brigade during the War of Independence. You describe in the book how Cahill was disliked intensely by many, but that the men in his circle were fiercely loyal to him. Indeed, several times, as you point out, his right-hand man, Tighe Brosnan, turned down offers from senior IRA figures to take over as commandant. Why do you think it was that GHQ was out to get Cahill? Did they genuinely believe that he was not doing very much, that he just wasn't up to the job?
They did, in fairness, I believe. Like the reason I told you about the fact that he wasn't sending in reports probably led to Mulcahy believing that there was nothing happening there. But there was other reasons as well. For example, there was a priest in Tralee, a Father Beaton, who was a rabid Republican. This priest actually wanted to go out on missions with the volunteers armed and take an active part in ambushes. And he considered that Cahill wasn't doing enough as brigade commander. And he composed a letter of complaint and sent it to Mulcahy. He got it signed by four or five senior IRA people in Tralee. Mulcahy, when he read this letter, actually did the opposite of what Father Bean expected and sent down an execution order that the five who signed the letter would be executed. When this order got to Tralee, as you can imagine, there was mayhem. And it took Tighe Kennedy, the intelligence officer for the Kerry No. 1 Brigade, went straight to Dublin again and went to Collins first to try and get this order rescinded. Collins sent him to Cathal Brú to try and get the order rescinded, and Cathal Brú sent him to Mulcahy to get the order rescinded. And eventually, Mulcahy decided to rescind the order. But Mulcahy still took it upon himself to write to Cahill outlining the complaints against him. And a lot of the feeling would be that this left Mulcahy in the situation where he felt he had no choice but to resign. And there was a third reason as well, possibly, the Dispoil ambush, which took place in 22nd of March 1921, resulted in the death of three volunteers. The Tans actually turned the tables on the volunteers. Now, one of them died accidentally before the ambush, and the other two were killed in the course of the ambush. For that failed ambush, Cahill got the blame as well. And the fact that he didn't submit a report outlining exactly what happened in the course of the ambush did nothing to dissuade Mulcahy from believing that he was at fault. All these reasons combined led to Cahill feeling he had no option but to resign in around May 1921. His resignation ultimately led to the disbandment of the Flying Column, which had only been organised at this stage for about 3 months and which had taken part in about 6 major ambushes. They were disbanded and sent back to their districts. The hut they were in, or in Kiel, and up on the side of a mountain in Kiel, was dismantled, and the War of Independence for the Flying Column of the No. 1 Brigade in West Kerry actually finished 5 or 6 weeks before the truce.
Now, you mentioned somebody there, Tighe Kennedy, and he comes into the book quite a lot. Who was Tighe Kennedy? Why was he so important?
Tighe Kennedy was born in Enniskillen in 1885. He was an accountant with Kerry County Council, and he was also the intelligence officer for Kerry No. 1 Brigade. Ernie O'Malley, in his book, describes Tighe Kennedy as probably one of the best intelligence officers in Ireland, and that's no surprise. For example, the key to the decipher for the codes that the RIC used in their telegrams, Tighe Kennedy provided the key to break those codes to Collins at the start of the war, and he kept providing them every month all through the course of the war, and every time they were changed, he provided them. In his intelligence network, he had 2 county inspectors, a district inspector, 2 special crime sergeants, and numerous other sergeants, as well as a Captain O'Malley from the Royal Munster Fusiliers, who were based in Tralee, and a wireless operator from the Army Barracks in Ballymullen in Tralee. His intelligence network was run along the railway line, basically, but his value to Collins, I think, has never been fully recognised. His value to Collins was such that when Collins was actually going over to negotiate the treaty in 1921, he asked Tighe Kennedy to accompany him. Due to the situation in Kerry, which we just described, Tighe actually refused. He was afraid Kerry was on the verge of civil war and so on. And that's the reason he didn't accompany Collins over to London.
But Collins did use him during the treaty negotiations at a crucial point during those negotiations, didn't he?
He did, without a doubt, and it happened in November 1921. Collins was home for probably to debrief the Dáil as to what was happening in London, and probably giving an indication as well of how serious they viewed the situation. There was a meeting arranged while Collins was home that weekend to try and resolve the situation with Kerry No. 1 Brigade. Present at that meeting was Collins, De Valera, Cathal Brú, Richard Mulcahy, Andy Cooney, Tighe Kennedy and Tighe Brosnan, and 1 or 2 more. They didn't resolve the situation, but Kennedy describes in his witness statement how himself and Tighe Brosnan and Collins went for lunch on the Saturday, and Collins tasked him with a job of going over to Portsmouth, which was the headquarters of the British Navy at the time. Collins had a contact inside in the Navy. He was a man by the name of Russell from Ballydavid originally, believe it or not. And he was a member of the IRB. And the task, Collins said, Kennedy, was to discover whether Lloyd George was bluffing or not when he stated that he was in a position to blockade Ireland if Collins didn't sign the treaty. Russell did indeed confirm to Kennedy that the British were recommissioning ships that had been decommissioned after the First World War. So he was making preparations for a blockade of Ireland, and that probably played a big part as to why Collins actually signed the treaty. He knew Lloyd George was not bluffing.
Tell us then about Cumann na mBan in Kerry. How big a role did Cumann na mBan play during this period?
Well, my own belief is that the War of Independence countrywide could not have been the success it was without Cumann na mBan. And this would be as true of West Kerry as the rest of Ireland. The first organiser in West Kerry was Bridget Coakley Kennedy from Cassie Gregory, who organised Cumann na mBan branch there in 1914. After 1916, it waned a bit, but she was centrally involved again when it started reforming in 1917, 1918. And in those few years, she organised branches in Lisbon, in Ocashley, in the Maharees, in Cassie Gregory, Camp, Ballyduff, Clahan, and Dingle, the main duties of covering the man as compared to the rest of the country in a lot of ways. They acted as spotters, as couriers and messengers. They were hiding and transporting and maintaining arms. They were providing safe houses, food and clothing, and they were nursing and comforting the wounded and assisting in Sinn Féin courts and raising funds and actually making ammunition as well. There was a few women now from, say, West Kerry that would deserve mention. Katie McCarthy, for instance, from Cassie Gregory, describes at one stage, probably in early 1921, rushing out the back door of their house in the village and hiding rifles in seaweed outside while the tants were knocking on the front door to come in. And they got away with that. Then you have, like, say, Una Moriarty from Inch describes receiving bullets hidden in crocks of jam sent from her sister in London. And she actually went to London at one stage and smuggled home a trunk full of arms. Siobhan Cleary from Ballymore, near Dingle, was a member of Cumann na mBan in Cork, and she went anti-treaty. She was arrested and interned in Mount Jai, and she went on hunger strike there. And her health suffered badly as a result, and she actually died in 1924 at the young age of 25. The coroner and her inquest attributed her death to the ill health she suffered as a result of her incarnation and subsequent hunger strike. And now there's 14 names on the Republican memorial cited in the Mall in Dingle. They're all men, and I personally believe that her name should be amongst it, those names.
Now, Noel, when it comes to the Civil War, Kerry leaps to mind for the sheer level of brutality in the county during the Civil War. But would it be fair to say that, based on his impression of what was going on in Kerry during the War of Independence, that Richard Mulcahy wasn't expecting much opposition to the Free State forces there?
Probably not. The atrocities in Kerry, the worst of them happened in 1923. When the Free State Army landed in Kerry in August 1922, they had a fair bit of success. There was actually an attempt made in November 1922 to call a halt to the civil war in Kerry. Tyke Kennedy, at this stage, was in jail. Now, Tyke Kennedy remained neutral in the civil war, but he was still jailed because they were afraid of him. But while he was in jail, he was approached by the spy in the castle, Dave Nelligan, with a view to approaching Paddy Cahill and trying to negotiate a ceasefire in Kerry. Tyke got his contacts to contact Cahill, and Cahill agreed to come in and open talks on the promise that he was guaranteed safe passage. The meeting duly took place, but that night the Free State Army raided Paddy Cahill's home in Tralee. Now, Paddy Cahill wasn't staying there, but obviously, as far as he was concerned, his free passage guarantee had been violated, and he left. There was no more talks. So I often wonder whether or not, if those talks had continued, would we have been spared the horrors of the worst atrocities in Kerry in 1923?
And they were pretty atrocious, as you know, and I'm sure as many of our listeners know. Noel, the book is a wonderful book. It's a hefty one, 300 pages long, beautifully illustrated with photographs and pull-out maps. A very, very impressive production indeed. Congratulations on that. And it's called War in the West, 1918 to 1923, The Struggle for Irish Independence on the Dingle Peninsula. It's available from Mountain Range Press. Their website is mountainrangepress.com. And the author is Noel O'Murricu. Noel, thank you very much for joining us on The History Show this evening.
Thank you, Miles.
That's all we've time for on this evening's programme. Details of all our items, as well as podcasts, are available on our website, rte.ie/historyshow. Special thanks tonight to Brian Namock, production engineer in Tralee, for his assistance. Our researcher is Liz Gillis. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye, and thanks for listening.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.